This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
But the people here are really desperate. I mean, a lot of them have identified in Darfur.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch assessing the plight of migrants trapped by the fighting over the Libyan capital Tripoli. Details coming up also. In Mozambique, heavy rains has washed away many of the crops, with the UN estimating that 1.85 million people, including a million children, need medical assistance, shelter and food. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, in Libya, tens of thousands of people are under threat from fighting around Tripoli. The forces of General Khalifa Haftar continue to try to capture the city from the government of National Accord. The situation is particularly dire for thousands of migrants who entered Libya months and even years ago, hoping to travel on to Europe. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Tripoli. Today, she updates us on the situation for those who have been displaced. Many of them are migrants.
Right now, I'm at a displacement camp for foreign residents evacuated the war zone in Tripoli in the past couple of weeks. Most of the people here are from various countries in Africa. Almost all have applied for asylum.
Thousands of other migrants are held in detention centers, but conditions in those facilities are not clear.
There's a lot of chaos and misinformation about that right now. And for whatever reason, the government is blocking journalists this week from those camps. As far as I know, it was about 10 days ago the last time there was the open ability to walk in and out of the detention centers.
Many of the migrants had fled earlier wars in places such as Sudan and find themselves trapped again.
But the people here are really desperate. I mean, a lot of them have identified in Darfur. So they have been in camps and on the road. Many have been on their travels kidnapped, had family members killed in various wars.
While non-combatants seek shelter from the conflict, soldiers say a key battle may be starting near a major hospital in Tripoli.
It is also a space where there are key supply lines that are supplying the National Army.
Murdoch says the battle could be pivotal if General Haftar's forces capture the area and cut off supplies to the troops of the government of National Accord. Haftar's forces have controlled much of the country's east over the past several years. Last month, they began pushing towards the capital, where the United Nations-backed GNA is based. Tomorrow is World Press Freedom Day, set aside by the United Nations to honor journalists and their efforts to hold governments accountable and keep the public informed. This commemoration has special resonance in today's Sudan, where, among other demands, protesters continue to press for an end to censorship and the assurance of safety for those who report the news. To find out more about press freedoms in Sudan since President Bashir's ouster on April 11th, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Justin Shiluda, the Middle East and North Africa Research Association for the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York.
During Omar Bashir's time in power, Sudanese journalists were subject to all manner of different restrictions. A lot of it took the form of day-to-day harassment and censorship, whether they're state-aligned newspapers, independent newspapers, newspapers aligned with opposition parties that would try to cover something sensitive to the authorities, such as protests or rise in bread prices or ethnic conflict in different parts of the country.
So what did the government do to harass newspaper journalists?
The government would have a practice of pre- or post-publication censorship. That could mean intelligence agents go to the office of the printing press and say this article has to be pulled, or that could mean they prevent the newspapers from being distributed, or it could mean that they're actually confiscated from the points of sales.
Did Bashir's government actually arrest journalists outright?
Yes. This was especially true during the past few months, but also over the past couple of years, too, as the economic situation in Sudan deteriorated, we definitely saw an uptick of the amount of detentions of journalists, the lengths of detentions, and the treatment of journalists in detention being subjected to torture, to ill treatment, to assault. We definitely saw quite a bit of it in the run-up to Omar Bashir's removal from power.
Can you give me a couple of examples?
One fairly significant case recently was that of Osman Mirghani, who was detained for more than a month. His family had told us that he was held in a cell with four other people in a jail in Khartoum known as the refrigerator because of the temperatures in which they deliberately hold the inmates. It's also a detention site known for torture and brutal treatment of journalists. That was kind of the serious escalation of a trend that we've seen since last year. We also, in 2018, documented the arrest and assault while in detention of Amal Habani, that she was physically beaten and tortured while in detention.
And you've said that this ill treatment actually escalated between December, when the protests really began, and April 11th, when Bashir was actually ousted.
Sure. In fact, from that period, we saw a lot more detentions of journalists. They were very hard to keep track of because the Sudanese authorities had a catch-and-release policy, essentially. They did this not only with journalists, but with activists and protesters as well. And at one point, they had to stop arresting people just because they were running out of room in their prisons.
Now that we've had at least a few weeks' track record, are you noticing any blossoming of free journalism there, or is it still kind of a wait and see?
From what we've been following, Sudanese journalists who are talking on social media, they're saying that people were able to print headlines that they may not have been previously able to. So there's certainly some promise and some optimism. There still very much is a state of flux in terms of the Sudanese leadership, and so it remains to be seen whether this will lead to an environment where press freedom can truly flourish. I mean, at the end of the day, people want their problems acknowledged. They want solutions, and part of that would be reflected in reporting on those problems in the press. We know that the journalists want it. We see society as large demanding it, and in that sense, the ball is very much in the authorities' court.
Is there anything you want to say about non-newspaper journalism, broadcast, online, social media, etc.?
All the different media platforms, whether it's online, social media-based, or whether it's print, radio, television, are all critically important. The Sudanese population knows that, the journalists themselves know that, and the authorities know that too, which is why they're also revoking, say, the credentials of Al Jazeera journalists. Certainly the journalists have been doing more than their share in pushing for that space, and the question is whether the authorities will respond to that.
That was Justin Chilud of the Committee to Protect Journalists speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Mozambique was already in need of help from drought, with 1.8 million people facing crisis levels of food insecurity when the poor country was hit by a pair of powerful cyclones. Now the heavy rains have washed away many of the crops, with the UN estimating that 1.85 million people, including a million children, need medical assistance, shelter, and food. Aid is slow getting to some areas where flooding has blocked roads, crushed hospitals, and contaminated wells. Some residents worry that their meager supplies of food will run out before help can arrive. Yesterday, the World Food Program flew its first aid to the island, of where Cyclone Kenneth's winds demolished almost every wooden home in their path and ripped the bark from trees. Business interests have made Cyril Ramaphosa one of the richest people in Africa, and he is likely to be re-elected president of South Africa next week. The 67-year-old father of four is the son of a policeman and a housewife who sold home-brewed beer for extra income for their home in Soweto near Johannesburg. In this report, Darren Taylor tells us more about the leader of the African National Congress, or ANC, the party that's won every election in democratic South Africa since 1994.
In South Africa, the popular president, Cyril Ramaphosa, is somewhat affectionately referred to as Mac Buffalo. This because he once owned 145 McDonald's fast food outlets and bought an expensive buffalo for one of his game ranches. but Ramaphosa's best known for his lead role in the struggle against apartheid. In Parliament earlier this year, he recalled one of the many times the racist government security police cracked down on him.
And I was arrested, transported to Pretoria Central Prison. I was in solitary confinement for a solid 6 months before anyone came to talk to me. Then later they started interrogating me, which was quite vicious. I will not go into that.
Ramaphosa was expelled from university because of his politics, but he went on to help establish the National Union of Mine Workers, a major irritant to the apartheid government. After ANC leader Nelson Mandela was released from prison in 1990, he put Ramaphosa in charge of the negotiations to end apartheid. Since Ramaphosa replaced President Jacob Zuma last year, many political analysts say he's done a good job of restoring order to government and addressing the corruption that thrived under Zuma. But his administration's been tainted by his links to Bosasa, a company that allegedly bribed top ANC officials to win big state contracts. Tera Lakota's just one of several opposition politicians to accuse Ramaphosa of himself being involved in graft.
Now you are inviting us to join you in the corruption of Bosasa, in the corruption of all of these things you've been doing with the others. I'm sorry, sir. I will stay with the people in Khayelitsha, in Shawelo and Soweto, and so on. I thank you. I'm grateful you are a billionaire.
Ramaphosa has denied all allegations of impropriety. Another shadow he can't escape is that of the so-called Marikana massacre in 2012, when police shot dead 34 protesting miners at a mine near the town of Rustenburg. Ramaphosa sat on the board of the company that owned the mine. After miners became violent before the shootings, Ramaphosa called for concomitant action to be taken against them. A subsequent inquiry cleared him of any responsibility for the killings. Adam Habib is one of South Africa's most respected political analysts and says Marikana and other stains don't disqualify Ramaphosa from leadership.
He's not perfect by any means, but we're not in the game for creating angels. We are in the game for creating who's the best political leader under the circumstances. And it seems to me that Cyril Ramaphosa does meet that criteria.
But a question that's often asked here is, where was Ramaphosa's moral voice when Zuma and his acolytes mismanaged and allegedly plundered the nation's purse? He was, after all, Zuma's deputy for 4 years. Political commentator and former ANC MP Melanie Verwoerd defends a man she knows well.
Not even Cyril Ramaphosa had any idea of how bad it got and how wide the web was and how much money was at stake. That's the first answer. The second answer is that I believe that even though he knew certain things, he is a man who understands how to play the long game.
By this, Verwoerd means that Ramaphosa waited to lead South Africa for 2 decades, and that to have moved against Zuma too early would have ruined Ramaphosa's career and those of his supporters. Despite his popularity, Ramaphosa's inability to invigorate the economy and to fully prosecute those suspected of corruption may drive many voters away from the ANC. Still, the party and Ramaphosa are expected to take nearly 60% of the vote next week. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. In Libya, tens of thousands of people are under threat from fighting around the capital, Tripoli. And in Mozambique, because of the cyclone, heavy rains have washed away many of the crops, with the UN estimating that 1.85 million people, including 1 million children, need medical assistance, shelter, and food. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In the Gambia, a surge in cross-border crime is being fed by organized gangs stealing from communities and then selling their haul to neighboring countries. English to Africa reporter Pandera Mbai reports.
The Gambia is increasingly becoming a hub for theft and petty crimes. Police have arrested an organized gang accused of operating both locally and across national borders. In the commercial town of Serekunda and its surrounding settlements, burglars have been hitting mobile phone shops and neighborhood stores, snatching whatever they can lay their hands on. Vehicles, cattle, flat-screen TVs, and other valuables were also stolen. The thieves will in turn smuggle the items to neighboring Senegal and Guinea-Bissau to be sold. Assistant Superintendent of Police ASP Lamin Jai is the spokesperson for the Gambia Police Force.
The anti-crime unit has been busy over the period of time running after criminals and criminal activities to ensure that we put a stop to the criminality that is going on. And even if we are not able to do this, but we will make sure that wherever crime is found, we fight against it.
The gangs are usually armed with cutlasses and other weapons. They would steal whatever valuable they could lay their hands on. Some of their partners in crime are Senegalese and Guinean nationals. Neighboring Senegal has also suffered a surge in crime, and war-ravaged Guinea-Bissau is also being used as an outlet to traffic stolen valuables. The Gambia Police Force have contacted their counterparts in Senegal. Superintendent Gorgui Mboub is the commander of Gambia's anti-crime unit force. Mboub says their operations to pursue the alleged thieves sometimes transcend regional boundaries. One vehicle was stolen less than 2 weeks after it was bought. Some thefts are family affairs.
Malik Njai took these watches and the flat screen and the mobile phones to Guinea-Bissau, where he went and sold it. Malik Njai is right now in our custody. He managed to call his brother, who tried to get one of the televisions back from Guinea-Bissau, and is that other one that is there?
Youths make up over 60% of the Gambian population. Lack of employment opportunities have been partly blamed for the surging crime rate. Superintendent Mboub says the organized gangs are sometimes armed with pepper sprays, like the ones being used by the police. They are wear masks.
This is the same tool that they used to break into this cigarette store and then got all these cigarettes out. So when they got these cigarettes, what they do is they have a market readily waiting for them. And then this market are non-Gambians. They give it to them and they will give them small money. At the end of the day, these people will go outside the Gambia, dispose these items that are sold to them, and then come and give them the rest of their balances.
Gambian youngsters are usually armed with scissors for late-night stealing sprees. They are often under the influence of drugs and will starve anyone trying to stop them.
If little children of this age in the Gambia can engage themselves in looting a full house, what will happen if they are 20 years, 25 years? But let me assure every Gambian that the anti-crime of the Gambia Police Force is here to stop this.
Meanwhile, police spokesman Lamin Jai has called on the public to avoid buying stolen goods and report any suspected crime in their neighborhoods. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
Rugby is one of Kenya's most popular sports, and the country's national team has played in the World Cup. Inspired by the national team's success, members of Kenya's deaf community launched a deaf rugby team last year. The team has big dreams for the future. Sarah Kimani files this report from Nairobi.
As the door slams behind him and Martin Kaisovia begins his journey to the rugby pitch, there's a rush of excitement in his eyes. He had played football as a child, but never played rugby until a year ago when officials of the newly formed Kenya Deaf Rugby Association came to his church. Martin was born deaf and has largely remained within the deaf community in Kenya. For this story, he speaks to VOA through a sign language interpreter.
Before, when I was growing up, there was no deaf rugby. But I used to see that people like joining new things. Then I decided, let me go with the new thing.
At the pitch, about an hour's commute from his house, Martin joins 16 other players for practice. This has become the team's weekly Sunday afternoon routine. Maurice Okwach formed the team in the Kenya Deaf Rugby Association to support it. Speaking through a sign language interpreter, Okwach explains his motivation.
Kenya, we only, the people who are hearing are the ones who have a rugby team. So we thought, let's copy South Africa also. Let's form our team.
Deaf rugby is also played in Australia, Canada and England, and the sport is represented at the Deaf Olympics, which comes up next in 2021. The players in Nairobi haven't played a game yet and don't have a sponsor. They make do with what they have, one ball and mismatched second-hand uniforms. Okwach says the team is currently self-supporting.
When we formed this group, I tried to look for funding, but it was very difficult. And the committee, ourselves, we decided let's first of all chip in. So we chipped in, we bought a ball as a committee.
There's no whistle here. The team's coach, Brennan Rashid, communicates with players through sign language. In a professional deaf rugby match, the referee waves a white flag to draw the attention of the players. Unlike the players, Rashid is not deaf. He says that despite a lack of playing experience, the team is getting better.
I have seen the progress. I've seen them taking it step by step, going places with it. I have seen them getting a proper understanding of the game, and that's just the best thing that I can give.
Despite the various hardships, Kasuvia and the other players have big dreams, like competing in the Deaf Olympics. He says his goal is to win the gold. Sarah Kemani for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's VOA Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
As the Don slumps behind him and Martin Kaisovia begins his journey to the rugby pitch, there's a rush of excitement in him.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.